Okay, welcome to, good day to you all. This is Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class. It's August 28th, 2022. And Dr. Ross will be here next week also, and then he'll be away after that. He's here today with us. Today's presentation is Supernatural Galaxies. Dr. Ross, come on up.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark. And how many of you know what this is? Have you ever done any gambling or played a dice game? What do they call this outcome? Boy, none of you have ever?
Snake eyes.
Snake eyes, that's it, snake eyes. Okay, what's the probability of rolling snake eyes?
One out of
12? Actually, it's slightly more remote than 1 out of 12 because notice we got the heavy side of the dice up. So it's actually a little bit less. So, but what are the odds of rolling 16 consecutive snake eyes? Not quite impossible, but it's about one chance in a sextillion. So if you were to see someone rolling snake eyes over and over again 16 consecutive times, what would you conclude about the dice?
These dice are fixed.
These dice are fixed. They've been designed to come up snake eyes every single time. Matter of fact, in Las Vegas, if they were to see four consecutive snake eyes, they would pick up the dice and replace them. The odds of getting four consecutive snake eyes is so remote, they said, it's got to be fixed. It's got to be designed. Well, I'm going to be using the same kind of reasoning that you see in Las Vegas when we look at our Milky Way galaxy. Yeah, as announced, the title is Our Supernatural Galaxy. And have you ever watched any one of these Star Wars movies? They all begin with this opening tagline, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Now, I have a problem with these Star Wars movies as an astronomer because I look at this sentence and I said there's two things wrong with it. It can't be a long time ago and there is no galaxy far, far away. If you want to have advanced life, it takes a minimum time in the history of the universe to get the conditions that are necessary for that advanced life. And guess what, all of you sitting here, you're all here at the very minimum time in the history of the universe to make advanced life possible. So it can't be a long time ago. A long time ago in the history of the universe lacked the conditions anywhere within the universe that would make possible the existence of life. And what I'll be showing you briefly is that there is no galaxy that we astronomers see up close or far, far away that has the conditions that would make possible advanced life except for Milky Way galaxy. And the truth of the matter is there is no galaxy cluster far, far away or no super galaxy cluster far, far away. This is the galaxy cluster Abel 1300. You can see that in the middle there you got a supermassive galaxy many times larger than our Milky Way galaxy. It's a giant galaxy, but it's not the only giant galaxy image. There's many giant galaxies. And likewise, we see the same thing in Abel 2744. George Abel, if you're not aware of him, he was a famous astronomy professor at UCLA, and he produced an exhaustive map of a big galaxy clusters. But likewise, again, you not only see these giant galaxies, notice how closely they're jammed together. And when you have galaxies that big and that tightly jammed together, it means that everywhere within that galaxy cluster, you're going to have deadly radiation being emitted from the supermassive black holes in the center of the super galaxies. And this is what you see in virtually every galaxy cluster and supermassive galaxy cluster. So this is one has a colorful name, MAC 0416.1-2403. I don't know where astronomers come up with these exotic names for their galaxies, but that's the way they do it. And You know, this one has just been released by the James Webb Space Telescope, and one of the missions of the James Webb Space Telescope is to able to actually image galaxy clusters and supermassive galaxy clusters in far more detail than what was possible with the Hubble Space Telescope or any other telescope. And this particular image not only shows you the galaxies, the giant galaxies and large and small galaxies that make up the cluster SMAC0723, but if you look in the background, and by the way, wherever you see these six spikes coming off, that's an indication you're looking at a star and not a galaxy. But as you look at this image, you notice you only see a few of those. There's one here, one down here, one here, one up here. Everything else is a galaxy. Well, there's a couple here as well. But in the deep background, you can see galaxies that are billions of light years more distant. And so it's revealing for us for the first time just how many galaxies exist in the universe. The number that astronomers throw at now is in the observable universe, there are 2 trillion galaxies. 2 trillion galaxies, where each galaxy has 100 billion stars within it. Adds up to more than 1 trillion stars in the immensity of the universe. And, you know, last time I was with you, I talked about the unique design of the supermass or the super galaxy cluster in which we exist, the Laniakea super galaxy cluster. And I showed you this map. And what a super galaxy cluster is a cluster of clusters of galaxies. But what I was demonstrating the last time I was with you is that our super galaxy cluster is unlike any other. The others have the galaxy clusters jammed tightly together in kind of a basketball shape or a football shape, but the Laniakea super galaxy cluster in which we exist, the galaxy clusters are strung out along long filaments. So you see a filament here, you see a filament across here, you see a filament down here, and this is where you see the large galaxy clusters. Note too that the large galaxy clusters are all shifted towards the right. So, and here is our local group, and what you notice here is we're not even on a filament, we're on the nexus of 3 subfilaments. And in the next slide, I'll show you a zoom in on the neighborhood of our local group. This arrow is actually pointing to the Milky Way galaxy here. This galaxy over here is the Andromeda galaxy. So the local group is basically like this. And these are other groupings of galaxies that are nearby our local group of galaxies. And notice all the other groupings of galaxies. They have giant galaxies. Ours has no giant galaxies. It's got 2 large galaxies. Everything else is dwarf galaxies. Note, too, that these large galaxies are spread far apart from one another, whereas all the other groupings of galaxies in the vicinity local group, you see dozens and dozens of galaxies jammed tightly together, where there's not just 2 giant galaxies, there's 2 large galaxies. There's many large galaxies and even some giant galaxies. And then we zoom in on the local group. And this map, by the way, was developed by us at Reasons to Believe, where you see the Andromeda galaxy to the upper left, the Milky Way to the lower right. And then this map also shows you the 5 large-sized dwarf galaxies. We got the Triangulum galaxy here, which is a spiral galaxy, but it's relatively low mass. It actually has a much smaller mass than the Large Magellanic Cloud nearby our Milky Way galaxy. That's the 3rd most massive galaxy in the local group. And where does it come in? About 1/16th the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. You got the Small Magellanic Cloud over here, and then you got 2 dwarf galaxies on either side of the Andromeda galaxy. But this is a local grouping of galaxies that's like any other we observe in the universe, where it only contains 2 large galaxies, both spiral galaxies. That's rare because today most of the galaxies in the universe are elliptical or spheroidal galaxies or irregular galaxies. The rarest galaxy type are the spiral galaxies. And yet in the local group, we have four spiral galaxies, the Milky Way, the Andromeda Galaxy, the Triangulum Galaxy, and the Large Magellanic Cloud. So the four largest galaxies are all spiral galaxies, but only two of them are large. There are no giant galaxies, and you can see how far apart the Andromeda and the Milky Way galaxies are, far enough apart that the gravity being exerted by the Andromeda Galaxy has no effect on the shape or structure of the Milky Way galaxy. The gravitational effect is just way too small. Moreover, the supermassive black hole in the Andromeda Galaxy is far enough away that its radiation has no threat for animal life on planet Earth. On the other hand, its supermassive black hole is about 35 times more massive than the one in the Milky Way. And even though it's 2.5 million light years away, when that supermassive black hole is active, and what I mean by active is when it's consuming bodies, as say as large as our moon or larger moons or planets, it will radiate radiation deadly enough to be a problem for a human civilization and human life here on planet Earth. Now, another unique factor of the local group are the sizes of the dark matter halos that encompass both the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy. And so this next slide, and by the way, this is not in the book Design to the Core. This is new material that's been developed. I do discuss it briefly in the book, but developed this diagram. And here you see the Andromeda Galaxy and the huge dark matter halo that encompasses it. But notice that the dark matter halo around the Milky Way has more than twice the diameter of the dark matter halo. Now, both of these dark matter halos are exceptionally large for the galaxies that they encompass. But the Milky Way Galaxy holds the record for the biggest dark matter halo we've ever been able to discover around a galaxy, at least the biggest one relative to the mass of the galaxy. The dark matter halo surrounding the Milky Way is 90% of the total mass of the Milky Way galaxy. So this is to scale, and actually you can see how the halo, dark matter halo around our Milky Way galaxy almost reaches halfway towards the Andromeda galaxy. Now, the Andromeda galaxy is moving towards the Milky Way galaxy, and so if you wait long enough, a little more than 4 billion years, the dark matter halos will begin to merge. And when they begin to merge, it is inevitable that the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy in due time likewise will merge. They will no longer be spiral galaxies. They're going to become either lenticular galaxy, a single lenticular galaxy, or they'll become a giant ellipsoidal galaxy. And here are two views of the structure of the dark matter halo that encompasses our Milky Way galaxy relative to the spiral structure. That's those black curvy things you see there. And then the light gray you see here is the ordinary matter gaseous disk. And so there's a disk of gas that's actually larger than the spiral arm structure, a little bit larger, but beyond that, we have this huge dark matter halo. So that's looking at a plan view. Here's a side view, which basically shows you it's not spherical, it's an oblate spheroid. So it's a little bit, in terms of the z-axis, is a little bit less than the x and y axes. And so here again, the black represents the stellar structure. So you see the stellar central halo and the spiral arms, and then you see this very thin disk of gas. That's the white part, and the rest of it is this dark matter halo. I'm focusing on the dark matter halo because the extent of the halo and the mass of the halo play a crucial role in explaining why our Milky Way galaxy has such exceptionally symmetrical spiral arms. I'll be showing you the symmetry of the spiral arms of galaxies that come the closest to matching our Milky Way. But if you want to know why our Milky Way galaxy stands out and having spiral arms that are exactly the right distance apart from one another to make possible advanced life, and why they're so very symmetrical, a lot of the credit goes to this huge dark matter halo. Now, as astronomers have studied, I mean, the two galaxies they have studied in the most detail are our galaxy and the Andromeda Galaxy. And what we now realize is the Andromeda Galaxy is a typical large spiral galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy is the outsider. It's the one that is unique. The Andromeda Galaxy has features that are typical of other large spiral galaxies. And so what I've done in this slide is basically to compare the characteristics of the Milky Way galaxy with the Andromeda Galaxy. And what's interesting is they both have about the same mass. They both come in at about 1.2 to 1.3 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. You say, what's the error on that? It's about plus or minus 0.1 trillion. So it's possible that our Milky Way might even be a little bit more massive than the Andromeda Galaxy. Time will tell. That's one of the projects for the James Webb Space Telescope, is to be able to measure the mass more precisely. But they're approximately the same mass, both more than a trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. But where they really differ, notice that the stellar mass, the mass of all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy, comes in at only 54 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun, whereas you've got double that in the Andromeda Galaxy. So they both have the same total mass, but in the Andromeda Galaxy, the mass of its stars is twice that of the Andromeda Galaxy. And you've already seen the dark matter halo for the Milky Way galaxy has an extraordinary diameter of nearly 2 million light years. It's the biggest one we've seen around any large galaxy, whereas in the case of the Andromeda Galaxy, it's a little bit less than 1 million. And also the length of the disk. And so both galaxies have a stellar disk, but the extent of the stellar disk in the Andromeda Galaxy is about double that of what we see in the Milky Way galaxy, which is what you'd expect given that the total mass of its stars is double that. And this is something that was just published. I put out a weekly blog called Today's New Reason to Believe, and it was a few weeks ago that I put up an article making the point that one of the things that really distinguishes our spiral galaxy from all other known spiral galaxies is how far back in time you have to go before there was a previous large merger event. And you say, how do you define a large merger event? It's when the galaxy merges with a galaxy that's more than 1% the total mass of the galaxy. The last time that happened for the Andromeda Galaxy was a half billion years ago. Matter of fact, in December, we here at Reasons to Believe are going to be entertaining Dr. David Block from Witwatersrand University in South Africa. And he was the one that published in the British journal Nature his study of M32 passing through the Andromeda Galaxy a mere half billion years ago, and how that event was responsible for the incredible distortion you see in the spiral arm structure of the Milky Way galaxy. And that's typical for large spiral galaxies. They typically will merge with a large dwarf galaxy about once every billion years or once every half billion years, sometimes once every quarter billion years. The exception is our Milky Way galaxy. The last time that happened was 11 billion years ago. Now, if you got my latest new book, Design to the Core, I say in that book 10 to 10 and a half billion years ago, but a paper has now been published saying we know it goes back 11 billion years ago. they were able to come up with a much more precise measurement of when that happened. And when you look at the outskirt stars, these are the stars that are kind of in, there's a stellar halo that encompasses the Andromeda Galaxy as well as our Milky Way Galaxy. It's kind of a spherical shaped halo, about the same dimensions as the size of the spiral disk. In the case of the Andromeda Galaxy, those outskirt stars are highly mixed in their chemical structure, and their velocities show that they've been highly disturbed, whereas in the case of our Milky Way Galaxy, they're all old stars and they've been undisturbed. It's one of the pieces of evidence that we have that there's been no major merger event in the last 11 billion years. If that were the case, well, we would see the signature of that event in the outskirt stars, and we don't see such a structure. Now, what makes this extraordinary is that in order for a spiral galaxy to sustain its spiral structure, it must be consuming on a regular basis dwarf galaxies. Dwarf galaxies are very rich in dust and gas, and it's the infusion of dust and gas into the core of our Milky Way galaxy that sustains the spiral structure. And so if our Milky Way galaxy were to stop consuming these dwarf galaxies, within three or four rotations of the galaxy, the spiral arm structure would collapse and our Milky Way galaxy would cease to be a spiral galaxy. It would become a highly compressed spheroidal galaxy. Basically, the stars would all rush in towards the center, and that would become a non-candidate for life, of course, advanced life, because now you've got a galaxy where the stars are so close together, the mutual gravity would be disturbing the orbits of planets about the stars. Moreover, with a collapse of stars in like this, you're going to be feeding a lot of matter into the supermassive black hole. It's going to make the supermassive black hole bigger, and as mass is being accreted into the supermassive black hole, in the region just outside the event horizon, you get the conversion of matter into energy with 10 to 40% efficiency. And most of that conversion is radiated at X-ray and gamma ray wavelengths, which is deadly for advanced life. And so it's crucial that our Milky Way galaxy sustain its spiral structure. It's the symmetry of the spiral arms for many billions of years. And that's all possible because the Milky Way galaxy has two accompanying galaxies, the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud. You say, I've never seen the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds. Well, you've got to live in the Southern Hemisphere to see them. I've had the opportunity to see them both from South Africa and Australia, but they're around 70 degrees south latitude, so the farther south you are, the better view you get. But as I mentioned already, the Large Magellanic Cloud, in terms of its mass, not its size, it's quite compact, but it ranks as the third most massive galaxy in the local group. It comes in at about a quarter of a trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. So I need to correct myself. I said earlier is 1/16 the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. That's based on an old measurement. The new measurement tells us is about 1/5 the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. But as you look at this map here, the distance of the Large Magellanic Cloud, and in particular, the mass and the distance of the Small Magellanic Cloud, the spatial structure here is important. Because of this spatial structure, the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds actually act as a funnel, gravitationally streaming in tiny dwarf galaxies by it and into the core of the Milky Way galaxy. So it's thanks to this highly fine-tuned spatial structure and mass distribution that the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds can act as an efficient funnel, basically funneling in tiny dwarf galaxies at just the right rate into the core of the Milky Way galaxy, enriching it with the necessary gas and dust to continue to sustain the spiral structure. And astronomers have actually been mapping this in some detail for a few decades now. And this is a map that's been published, which basically shows you the large and small Magellanic clouds. Here's the large Magellanic cloud, the small Magellanic cloud. And here you see this streaming in of gas. So sometimes what's happening here is these tiny dwarf galaxies get gravitationally pulled towards the small and large Magellanic clouds. Their gas gets stripped. And so this red color here is basically mapping the gas that's streaming in towards the large and small Magellanic cloud and then moving in to the center of our galaxy. So this is what they call the leading arm. And it's an arm of gas and dust that's being funneled into the core of our Milky Way galaxy. And if it wasn't for that, you wouldn't see this amazing symmetry in the spiral arm structure of our Milky Way galaxy. I won't go into the details, but advanced life is possible only in a large spiral galaxy, and only if you have about half the stars in a barred core. So you see this core here, that's about half of the stars in our Milky Way galaxy. And many galaxies have a spherical core, but for advanced light to be possible, it needs to be a bar. And you need to have the spiral arm separated by just the right distance. That yellow dot, by the way, represents the position of our solar system. So we're far enough away from the center of the galaxy that we're not being wiped out by the radiation coming from the supermassive black hole. But because our Milky Way galaxy has only been absorbing tiny dwarf galaxies throughout its history, the supermassive black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy has not been feeding on a lot over the 13 billion years. By the way, our Milky Way galaxy ranks as one of the oldest galaxies in the universe. It's more than 13 billion years old. The universe is 13.8 billion, so our galaxy is one of the first to form. And for the last 11 billion years, it has sustained this amazing symmetrical spiral arm structure, where the spiral arms are just the right distance apart. And in terms of human civilization, it can only happen when we're halfway between two major spiral arms. And so that's where we are right now. We cross a major spiral arm about once every billion years, but the last time we crossed was about a half billion years ago. The next time will be a half billion years in the future. And so we're no longer in a major spiral arm. The Perseus spiral arm is on the outside. The Sagittarius spiral arm is on the interior side. On the other hand, in order to have the heavy element abundance, it's important that we be on a spiral arm, but we're in a small spiral arm, not a large spiral arm. Well, I've got a few minutes left before I need to finish. This is going to be a two-part series. I'll speak on this next week as well. But what I want to show you in the next few minutes are 18 spiral galaxies. So looking at the universe and picking out the galaxies that are most similar to our Milky Way galaxy, these are the 18 that come the closest to matching the spiral structure and the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. So in this particular slide, you see at the upper left, that's the Andromeda galaxy. It's referred to as the sister galaxy of the Milky Way galaxy because it has a similar mass. But as you saw from the table I showed you earlier, the Andromeda galaxy is radically different from the Milky Way galaxy. And David Block is going to be coming here in December. I'm going to try to get him to address the class here about his research on the Andromeda galaxy. But he was the one that pointed out, especially when you look at the Andromeda galaxy in the infrared part of the spectrum, this is an optical image, you can really see the distortion of the spiral arms. But even in this one, you can see how the spiral arms are bent and how a lot of the spiral arm structure has been pushed away from the center of the galaxy. And it's this galaxy here that passed through the center of the Andromeda galaxy about a half billion years ago. So that's the one you're probably more familiar with. The other five also show large spiral galaxies, but in each case you can see that the spiral arm structure is not symmetrical. Moreover, a common factor is in between the spiral arms, you see lots of spurs and feathers. And if I were to go back to the Milky Way galaxy here, you notice one of the features of our Milky Way galaxy is that, yes, there are feathers and spurs, but it's not completely dominated by feathers and spurs between the spiral arms. Most of the stars, indeed, are in the very symmetrical spiral arms, and you see a very different picture. For example, you look at that top middle galaxy, and you can see how the spurs and feathers really fill in virtually all the space between the spiral arms. But several of these have a barred spiral, one of the requirements for advanced light. They all have a bar, although the one to the upper right has a rather subtle bar. Here are six more where you can see. Now, these galaxies tend to be a little bit less massive than our Milky Way galaxy. And the smaller the mass, the more likely it's going to be disturbed by galaxies within its vicinity. And again, you can see that none of these have high symmetry spiral arms. The one that probably comes the closest is this one, but notice all the spurs and feathers between the spiral arms. And notice too, you can see considerable distortion of the arms, particularly the farther out arms, and you can see how they've been bent. This one has been referred to as being probably the closest to matching the Milky Way galaxy, but its mass is quite a bit less than our Milky Way galaxy. And here are the remaining six, although I put the Milky Way galaxy to the bottom right. And so you can see these galaxies here. And this shows you side by side the galaxy that astronomers have found that comes the closest to matching the features of our Milky Way galaxy. Where it really comes close is notice that the central barred feature is very similar to the central barred feature in the Milky Way galaxy, although it has a more dominant core than what we see in the Milky Way galaxy. And you do see that it's got the most symmetrical spiral arms of any galaxy in the list other than the Milky Way galaxy. But here again, you can see particularly the outer arms are experiencing significant distortion and a lot more spurs and feathers between the spiral arms. And notice a distortion of the inner spiral arms. That's a problem because that distortion is going to mean a lot more gas and dust. Moons, planets, and stars are going to be funneled into the supermassive black hole. And when that happens, you get a deadly radiation taking place. Well, I see I'm at 32 minutes, so I'm going to stop here, and we'll take questions, both from the virtual audience and the in-person audience here, and I'll finish next week on the rest of the highlights of the amazing features of our Milky Way galaxy that make advanced life possible in our Milky Way galaxy. I refer to this talk as the new evidence we have that our Milky Way galaxy is not just a chance occurrence. Kind of like rolling 16 snake eyes in a row, we see that in spite of the 2 trillion galaxies that exist in the universe, that this really is an extreme outlier, but an extreme outlier that's been designed, like some dice would be designed, to come up snake eyes every time. This has been designed in hundreds of distinct ways to make advanced life possible within a narrow window of time in our Milky Way galaxy. We'll speak about that narrow window next week. So I'll stop there, and we'll take questions, and we'll alternate between the virtual audience and the audience that's in person. Okay?
Okay. You want to go virtual audience?
That's fine.
Okay. Doug McComb has a question and concern regarding the definition of energy, that is to be the capacity to do work. Please give a detailed definition of energy.
Well, he's making the point that energy is something that gives us the capacity to perform work. And referring there to is electromagnetic energy or thermodynamic energy. And I appreciate Doug because astronomers are also aware of dark energy, which has got nothing to do with heat or light. It's basically energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe and therefore is not subject to the laws of thermodynamics. But yeah, I've taken a year-long course on thermodynamics when I was an undergraduate in physics. And it takes not only thermodynamics, but a high degree of entropy that makes work possible. And so, all of us here are eating food, and what we do when we eat food is that we burn that food up, and the capacity to do work is proportional to the temperature of the food that's being burnt and the temperature of the food, the waste products of the food that are being expelled. In case of your human body, we're talking just a few degrees. 1 degree is typical. It can maybe be as much as 2 or 3 degrees. But the efficiency of the work that you perform, say when you eat a hamburger or a falafel or whatever you eat, it's going to be that temperature difference between the burning of the food and the base temperature compared to the temperature of your body in Kelvin degrees. And so the temperature of your body in Kelvin degrees is what, around 300? And so if the temperature difference is, say, 1 degree, that means that your ability to take energy from your food and turn it into capacity to do work is only 0.3%. And the human body can get it up as high as 1%, but that's something to think about. When you're consuming food, only 1% of the energy you get from the food can actually be channeled to perform work. And so, but that's one of the definitions of heat energy or electromagnetic energy, is it's the energy that actually permits work to be done, but it depends on the temperature difference, which leads to probably where Doug is going, the heat death of the universe. The heat death of the universe is where every part of the universe becomes exactly the same temperature. In the universe today, we got hot bodies and we got cold bodies. And the the movement of energy from hot bodies to cold bodies is what makes work possible. But a time will come when the stars will all burn out and everything in the universe will be exactly the same temperature. And when that happens, work will be impossible. And when work is impossible, life is impossible. So yeah, a lot of my astronomer friends who are atheists are quite depressed because they're realizing within a quadrillion years, we're going to be hitting the heat death of the universe. That's going to be the end of all work, the end of all life, and the end of all consciousness. So we humans, if the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, as a professor of mine, Carl Sagan, once said in our classroom, we have no ultimate hope, purpose, or destiny. It's all gloom. So, next question.
On that same concept, perpetual motion motor, why is that impossible?
Well, I've actually have a relative on my wife's side who's invested a lot of his money in perpetual motion machines. I've been keep telling him it's a bad investment. A perpetual motion machine is basically a machine that keeps running, in other words, keeps doing work without the input of energy. And that violates the laws of thermodynamics. And so as I've been trying to tell this relative, it's not good to invest in something that violates the laws of physics for two reasons. The Bible tells us there's been no change in the laws of physics. So investing your money on the hope that the laws of physics will change is not a good idea. And as an astronomer, we make measurements throughout the entire universe. Everywhere we look, we see the laws of physics are exactly what we measure in the lab. As we look far away, we're looking back in time, which tells us throughout the entire 13.8 billion year history of the universe, there's been no change in the laws of physics. As we look throughout the spatial extent of the universe, no matter where we look, we see the same laws of physics. So that affirms what the Bible's been telling us for thousands of years. When God set up the laws of physics, he fixed them. Jeremiah chapter 33, the laws of physics are unchanging. In fact, God makes the point, hey, I'm a God that's immutable. I don't change. As proof, look to the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change. So yeah, I'd advise all of you, do not invest in perpetual motion machines.
Norm's got a question.
Hi, I had sent to me this past week a recent report that was, and I read the report off the internet, that reported the observation of a new exoplanet, and the exoplanet was a new one, and based on the observations, and they were able to calculate the mass of the exoplanet relative to the mass of the star, and therefore calculate the density of the exoplanet. Knowing the density and knowing its size, they then speculated out of that that there must be a water surface. I was wondering, that was published here just like a couple days ago, I think. I was wondering if you'd seen that, or if you had any ideas on that.
Yeah, Norm, I've not seen that, but that's not the first exoplanet where they've been able to do such measurements. They have found two other exoplanets that come in at about the same mass of our mass of the Earth, the same density, and roughly the appropriate distance from its host star that it could have liquid water on its surface. And water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe. So we shouldn't be surprised that there's lots of water on some of these exoplanets. And given the broad temperature range, 0 to 100 degrees, at the air pressure we have here on planet Earth, we would expect there'd be quite a few bodies where you'd have a significant quantity of liquid water. After all, astronomers are speculating that the moon Europa that orbits about Jupiter could be 35% water. And below the surface, there's enough tidal friction being exerted by Jupiter that much of the interior water of Europa could be in liquid form. So it's not a surprise there's liquid water, but one of the things I've written in my book, Improbable Planet, liquid water is a requirement for life, but the quantity of liquid water relative to the total mass of the planet must be fine-tuned. And I don't know about this third candidate, but the other two candidates, they're coming in with a water content that's 500 to 1,000 times that of planet Earth. And when you get that much water in a planet, if it is in liquid form, that means you're going to have deep surface oceans. I mean, on planet Earth, our oceans are, an average of 4 kilometers deep. If you got, say, 500 times as much water, you're now looking at oceans that are going to be more than 1,000 kilometers deep. And when you got that depth of liquid water, you're going to get ice that will form at the bottom, regardless of the temperature of the water. Why? Because you're going to have such a high density of overlaying liquid water that the water at the bottom will become frozen. Say, when does that happen? Hey, even if you only have 100 kilometers depth of water, the water at the bottom will be frozen solid. And when that happens, you've got a barrier between the liquid water and the rock. If you've got a barrier between the liquid water and the rock, there is no possibility of the development of any kind of life chemistry. And so, water-rich planets are not candidates for life. Now, I've written about that in some detail in two articles that are posted at reasons.org, two articles about the problem of too much water. So today's new reason to believe, I think they were posted about 2 years ago, but they're also cited in Design to the Core.
Okay.
And I just would add this, the reason why our Earth doesn't have that much water, it was born with that much water, but because it had a collision event with the other rocky planet Theia, it wound up losing more than 99% of its water and 99% of its atmosphere. That's another problem with planets that are water-rich. Water-rich planets will also have very thick atmospheres. And thick atmospheres are a problem for advanced life, because those atmospheres are going to be dominated by carbon and nitrogen, which carbon's a greenhouse gas, nitrogen is actually a catalyst that accelerates the greenhouse effect. And so you're going to have really high temperatures at the surfaces of those planets, far too high. In that case, the water is going to evaporate.
Okay. Here's a question from Caleb in Indiana. Is original sin the same as spiritual death, or is there a distinction?
Yeah, it depends how you define spiritual death, but most theologians would say there's no distinction. If you are born with sin, if there's an original sin that we've all inherited from Adam and Eve, then that means we're all in a state of spiritual death and therefore in need of a Savior that will deliver us from spiritual death. And that's the message you see in 1 Corinthians 15 and in Romans 5, is that there was a second Adam, namely the creator of the universe, Jesus Christ, who came to earth and conquered spiritual death, and therefore is enabling humans who so choose to be delivered from spiritual death unto spiritual life. And that's the born-again experience of Christians.
Let's see here. Keith Wilson, New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
He just wants a comment. The Magellanic Cloud can be seen circumpolar. Okay, it's just a comment from Keith.
Okay, no. Keith Wilson, living in New Zealand, I think what he's telling us, he's living at a latitude in New Zealand where he can actually see the small and large Magellanic Clouds circumpolar. To give an analogy for us living in the Northern Hemisphere, if you're living in Canada or the northern states of the United States, the Big Dipper is circumpolar, which means you can see it all night long any season of the year because of its very high latitude. Evidently, Keith is letting us know that where he lives in New Zealand, the large and small Magellanic Clouds, you can see all night long, all four seasons. Now, when I went to Australia and South Africa, I was not at that high of a southern latitude, so they weren't circumpolar. But evidently, Keith is living at a higher southern latitude, and they're circumpolar for him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's probably gotten a way better view than I ever got.
You think they would be visible to the naked eye like the Andromeda is? Or?
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, the large Magellanic Cloud is easily visible to the naked eye, unless you happen to be living in Sydney or Melbourne, where there's so much light pollution, you can't see the Milky Way either.
Okay. Tom Oy, O-E-Y, formerly in Germany, now in Wake Forest, North Carolina. How does one perceive dark matter through the telescope? Is it referenced in Genesis 1:4?
Yeah. The closest biblical reference I see to dark matter would be Job 38, where God asks Job and his friends a question. Do you know where darkness resides? Can you take me to its location? Now, it's interesting about that passage, I think it's Job 38, 19 and 20, is it's basically telling us darkness is a substance. It's not just the lack of light. And today, we astronomers know that, yes, there is dark matter out there in the universe. And this is matter that's composed of particles that don't strongly interact with light. In fact, they interact with light so weakly, we can't see any light from the dark matter clouds or the dark matter halos. And so people say, well, how come we know all this detailed structure of the dark matter halo that encompasses our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy? We know it from its gravitational influence. We can't see the particles, we can't see the light that's being emitted by this dark matter, but we can detect the gravitational influence of this dark matter. And so when we look at the structure, the spiral arm structure of a Milky Way galaxy, we know there's got to be a huge halo of invisible matter that's contributing to stabilizing that spiral structure. So, but yeah, a lot of people have claimed, hey, astronomers haven't really proven the existence of dark matter. It is true, we've not found the particles that are make up the dark matter, and it's because these particles interact in such a feeble way with light that it's going to be very difficult for us to detect those particles. But several efforts are underway, both by the CERN particle accelerator and by astronomers looking at the cooling curves of white dwarfs, where they're hoping relatively shortly, within a few years, to actually be able to detect the dominant particles that make up dark matter. Now, in one sense, we've already found some neutrinos are dark matter particles, and there's a lot of them in the universe, but we know they don't make up the necessary quantity of dark matter. Where we get the most accurate measurement of the quantity of dark matter in the universe is from maps of the cosmic microwave background radiation, the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. Those maps tell us there's about 5.5 times more dark matter in the universe than there is ordinary matter, matter made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons.
Okay. Norm, got a question?
Well, let me go a little bit further with the dark matter, and especially its relationship to the cosmic microwave background. So that we understand, I mean, the cosmic microwave background is electromagnetic radiation. And I guess I don't understand the connection, say, between dark matter and how they should be connected.
Well, let me tell you how they determine the quantity. Okay, they can look at these cosmic microwave background radiation maps, and we get the most detailed information from the Planck satellite and what's called the WMAP satellite. And those two tell us the total amount of density of stuff in the universe, and it adds up to what makes the universe geometrically flat in multiple dimensions. And we know about 70% of that cosmic density is made up of dark energy. The remaining density, about 30%, is matter. Now, we do have an accurate measurement of the quantity of ordinary matter. It's about 4.46% of the total density of the universe. So basically, they do a subtraction. We know the total matter of the universe. We know how much ordinary matter is. What's left must be this exotic dark matter, which comes in at about 23% of the total density of the universe. And there are telescopes at the South Pole, for example, that are attempting to give us even a more accurate measurement of those density factors. If you want to see a detailed description of that, in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, I have a chapter there on 21st century discoveries where I go into some detail about how astronomers look at the maps of the cosmic microwave background radiation and can determine the total density of the universe, then all the individual components. Things like what the dark energy is, what the total matter is. We look at the helium abundance in the universe. That gives us a measure of the ordinary matter. What's left is the exotic matter, but there's actually a very tiny percentage made up of relativistic particles. It comes in at about between 0.01 and a 0.1%. But the bottom line is, in fact, I actually give you a table of about six different components of the universe, but dark energy, dark matter, and ordinary matter make up 99.99% of all the stuff of the universe. But yeah, they can even make measurements of the remaining components.
Okay. See, Valerie has a question. What merged with the Milky Way galaxy 11 billion years ago and with the Andromeda galaxy 0.5 billion years ago?
Well, 0.5 billion years ago, if I can go back to this image. Yeah, here we go. Milky Way galaxy. You've got two dwarf galaxies that accompany it. This one down here and this one up here. That's M32. This is NGC.
Is that Andromeda or?
The Andromeda galaxy, right.
Okay.
So this is NGC 205. That's one of the large dwarf galaxies in the vicinity of the Andromeda galaxy. That's M32. Notice M32 is much more compact. And it was David Block who did velocity measurements of these galaxies at optical wavelengths and infrared wavelengths and determined that the M32 a half billion years ago had passed through almost right at the center of the spiral arm structure. And he was able to calculate that the distortion we observe in the spiral arm structure, more than 90% of that distortion can be attributed to that event that occurred about a half billion years ago. Now, similar studies have been done on the Milky Way galaxy over the past 30 years, and we now know that two galaxies, the Sausage Galaxy and the Enceladus Galaxy, those are the names they've put on them. So, yeah, I don't know where they come up with these names. But these are two dwarf galaxies that at the time, 11 billion years ago, were about 1% the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. And the Sausage Galaxy merged, no, that was the one that merged second. Enceladus merged first, and very soon after, the Sausage Galaxy merged. But both of them took place between 11 and 11 and a half billion years ago. And since that time, there's not been a single large spiral galaxy merging with our Milky Way galaxy. On the other hand, thanks to the mass and the positions of the large and small Magellanic clouds, our Milky Way galaxy has been consuming a tiny dwarf galaxy every few hundred million years. In fact, if you look near to the core of our Milky Way galaxy, let me zip ahead to that. Okay, astronomers have been making observations near this core feature, the Milky Way galaxy, and they can see these globular clusters. A globular cluster is like a dense cluster of old stars. The small ones will have 50,000 stars. The big ones will have 10 million stars. But astronomers now recognize the ones that come in over a million stars making up the globular cluster, they're actually the cores of absorbed dwarf galaxies. So the biggest globular cluster that we see in our Milky Way galaxy is Omega-3. By the way, you can see it from Los Angeles, but it comes just 3 degrees above the horizon. I think only in April can you get a good look at it. But through a telescope, it's about this, in terms of the spatial size in the sky, it's big enough that it's about the size of a full moon. So it's quite dramatic. And if you were to live in Australia or South Africa or New Zealand, when you look up, you can actually see it as quite a bright object. But it's got 10 million stars in it. But when we now realize it's actually big enough that it doesn't show up as a perfect sphere. It's slightly oblate, so it's experiencing some tidal distortion. And astronomers now realize that's the leftover remains of a dwarf galaxy that our Milky Way galaxy had absorbed. So our galaxy basically sucked all the gas out, and what's left are these old stars that are densely grouped together. And there's several of those we see in the Milky Way galaxy.
Would there be like small black holes also?
Yes, several globular clusters have what we call medium-sized black holes. By medium-sized, we mean they come in at thousands of times the mass of our star, the Sun. So if you look around our stellar neighborhood, we do see massive stars that have collapsed to become black holes. We call those stellar mass black holes. And they'll come in like 3 to 8 times the mass of our star, the sun. There's a couple that come in around 10. But in the cores of these globular clusters, what happens is these stellar mass black holes merge together to make bigger black holes. And so in Omega, the Omega globular cluster, there's a black hole that comes in at several thousand times the mass of our star, the sun. At the core of every big galaxy, there is a supermassive black hole.
Okay. Susan Lamb makes a poignant comment. It really bothers me that astronomers ignore, I could add biologists too and others, ignore all these facts when they talk about the likelihood of life in other galaxies. Just a comment. So.
Well, it's a comment, but I think it's based on the fact, I mean, let me give you an analogy. I see this happening in seminaries where you got professors of theology that become experts or one or two books of the Bible, but they're not comprehensively integrating all 66 books of the Bible. I remember a joke that Walt Kaiser shared when we were together. You know, he's an Old Testament professor, and he spent his whole life studying the Old Testament, and he jokes, yeah, I read the New Testament once and I liked it.
Okay.
But that's the point he makes. You really have to synthesize all the books of the Bible. The same thing's true of the book of nature. To really understand and answer the big questions of life, you need to be synthesizing all the subdisciplines of astronomy, and for that matter, all the disciplines that make up science. And most of my research astronomy peers, they're narrowly focused on one subdiscipline of astronomy. And therefore, they may not be aware of what we're talking about just in today's talk, is that, you know, if you really want to see what's going on in the Milky Way galaxy, you have to be integrating many different subdisciplines of astronomy. And that's rare. I didn't have the freedom to research all the disciplines of astronomy when I was on the faculty at Caltech. I had to focus on my narrow subdiscipline in order to be able to do my research.
Mm-hmm. The advantage of getting up there in age, you can learn a lot more. There's a question here from Robert Gibson. Will our galaxy ever pass close to the nearest part of the bar of the Milky Way galaxy? And if yes, what are the trade-offs if we get too close or too far from the bar? Is our star system's orbit about the Milky Way galaxy?
Okay, let me be clear, Mark. Yeah. Is he asking the question, will our solar system, our star, get close to the barred structure of the Milky Way galaxy? Is that his question?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That's not going to happen until the Large Magellanic Cloud begins to merge with the Milky Way galaxy and or the Andromeda galaxy begins to merge. Now, the measurements we've made so far tell us that the Large Magellanic Cloud, and it's going to drag the Small Magellanic Cloud with it, will eventually merge with our Milky Way galaxy. That's estimated to happen 4 to 4.25 billion years off into the future. And the Andromeda galaxy is calculated to merge with our Milky Way galaxy about 4.5 billion years from now. So when those merger events occur, yes, it will disturb the orbit of our star, the sun. How it will disturb it, we don't know. It could cause our star to be pushed away from the center of the galaxy or pushed towards the center of the galaxy. You say, what is more likely? It's more likely we're going to be pushed towards the center of our galaxy. So yeah, things don't look good starting about 4 billion years from now.
Okay.
But until then, I wouldn't worry. There's other things to worry about that'll happen a lot sooner than that.
Mm-hmm. Doug McComb has a question. How are the photos that depict the Milky Way galaxy constructed? Obviously, since we are in the galaxy, we cannot actually photograph it from the outside.
Good question from Doug. What you see here is an actual photo image of UGC 6093. What you see here is not a photo image. I mean, as you can imagine, it's not possible to send a spacecraft 200,000 light years away and have it take a shot of the Milky Way galaxy and send it back to us. That would be a 300,000-year project to pull off. So this is not a photo image. What it is a detailed reconstructed map. And it's based on astronomers observing the structure of a Milky Way galaxy at all different wavelengths. So for example, you couldn't reconstruct what our Milky Way galaxy looks like in terms of its structure to get that kind of detail if all you had was optical wavelengths. Because at optical wavelengths, the dust clouds that are Milky Way galaxy obscure what lies behind. But at radio wavelengths, they penetrate that dust. So they show us things we can't see at optical wavelengths. And when David Block comes here in December, he's going to be making the point at infrared wavelengths, we see different parts of our Milky Way galaxy than we see at optical wavelengths. And so this map you see here is basically astronomers observing our Milky Way galaxy at gamma ray wavelengths, X-ray wavelengths, ultraviolet, optical wavelengths, infrared, and a variety of radio wavelengths, and piecing it all together and coming up with that map. You say, well, given that it's a computer-constructed map based on these disparate observations, how accurate is this? Well, astronomers have been working on this at Caltech and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for about a quarter of a century. And every couple of years, they publish a more detailed map. This is the latest map that they produce. But I could show you an image of the map that they had just before that, a little less accurate. You really can't tell the difference. You can only tell the difference if you actually, you know, get out a magnifying glass and look at it in some detail. So it's actually quite an accurate map of what our Milky Way galaxy would look like at optical wavelengths. Okay, I'll take one more question, then I think we got to wrap things up.
I think we've finished.
We've
all
exhausted all the questions. Okay.
Yeah. So if you would close us in
prayer. Close us in prayer. That'd be great. Father in heaven, we thank you for giving us the technology that we can observe throughout the entire extent of our Milky Way galaxy and actually look way beyond into the great depths of the universe and really recognize how indeed we do live in a miraculous galaxy, a galaxy that you designed and fine-tuned to a degree way beyond what's possible to design dice that come up with 16 consecutive snake eyes. Lord, you've given us clear evidence. We thank you for that. Thank you for giving us the capacity to discern your fine-tuned designs, your miraculous work at hand to make our existence possible. And Father, I pray too that as we begin to absorb the implications of this, we'll realize the intended purposes for our universe, our galaxy, but most important of all, the purpose for which you created us human beings. Help us to discern the purpose of humanity, and in particular, help us to discern the purpose that you've given to each one of us as an individual human being, how each of us has a separate role. So, Father, I pray that you give us the grace, the humility, Lord, the love, the life, and the truth, that we can discern that and really please you in the way we serve you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.